Okay, so we're beginning. Okay, so now what I would like us to do here, I'm going to basically give you a sort of a story about philosophy and social theory roughly over the last 200, 250 years. And hopefully filling in a lot of the background that is still even taken for granted in introductory material that you might not be familiar with, okay? Now, if you have questions about this stuff as I'm speaking, because today I guess I will be mostly covering stuff having to do up to the end of the 19th century and then doing the 20th century next time. But if you've got questions that are kind of pressing in your mind, especially, you know, issues, you know, trying to gel, you know, get things kind of straight, given your own background, given what you already know about what I'm talking about, feel free to ask me, okay? Because I want to proceed kind of at the pace at which you can assimilate this stuff. Now, while I'm talking, one thing you might want to look at, because you emailed me, I think, yesterday or the day before, about this book I referred to, which is The Sociology of Philosophies, which gives you this complete kind of global theory of intellectual change, gives you complete kind of network analysis of the entire history of philosophy. That is to say, all the people who studied under whom and who corresponded with whom, and across all the traditions, East and West. The thing that's really striking, as I pointed out, was how you can get everybody, you can include everybody this way. So there's no, the only person, the only significant person that I found missing from this book who was not part of the established networks of philosophers talking to other philosophers and scientists and so forth was Machiavelli. Okay? That's really quite an interesting point in a way, because you would have thought, you know, given the sort of folk history of philosophy where philosophers are often imagined to be these kind of lone geniuses sitting on top of a mountain talking to nobody and whose works only get discovered after they die or something, right? That you would have thought that you couldn't do something like this, that you'd leave a lot of people out in the process. But in fact, this is not the case at all. Okay, and in fact, you just about include everyone. And you can sort of include everyone sort of in the way in which they're normally thought about. So that you end up finding the people who are in fact most significant have, as it were, the networks to the people who are most in institutional power. And I mentioned last time the example of Wittgenstein, who was very much a loner and a weirdo, right? Nevertheless, was very closely tied with Bertrand Russell, then was very closely tied with the Vienna Circle, which was very important in establishing modern philosophy of science, right? So if you actually flesh out who Wittgenstein was dealing with, he's dealing with, like, the most important people for establishing Anglo-American philosophy, at least, in the 20th century. Right, even though he himself has this reputation of being this kind of lone genius weirdo guy, okay. So this book kind of lays all this out, and you'll see periodically if you thumb through the book, there'll be these various graphs that kind of So here's one that covers the Germans in the second half of the 19th century, right? You see who begets who, and it's one of those kinds of things. So I'll pass this around while I'm speaking, so you can have a look at it. The book's not that expensive. I mean, it's paperback now, and those of you who really are interested in this, who have a kind of deep interest, not only in the sociology, but also the history of philosophy, I think the book is excellent, because it's really, and it's gotten good reviews from philosophers. Anthony Quinton reviewed it in the New York Review of Books when it first came out and gave it a positive review, for example. I have to say, my only, my main complaint about this book it's not a complaint, I guess it's, in a way, it's very much a philosopher's sociology of philosophy, in the sense that its database is the histories of philosophy that have been written in most of the major languages, in terms of who exactly to consider to begin with. Right, so who counts as a philosopher? It's basically the people who philosophers talk about. And then the question is going to be whether there's some interesting sociological ties between those people, right? So there is no attempt, from a sociological standpoint, to come up with an independent definition of what a philosopher is, other than they're the people other philosophers recognize. And so one of the things you don't get in this book, for example, very much, though it comes out sometimes, is you don't get anything like an ideological analysis of philosophy. That might explain why certain philosophical views are very strong, other than the fact that the people have a lot of students, for example. You don't get any kind of issue of, no real discussion about it corresponds to sort of the dominant ideology of the culture or something like that. You don't really get a lot of that kind of stuff going on in there. Okay, so it's very much a kind of philosopher's sociology philosophy. But it's really the only one we've got that's of the systematic and comprehensive, and is pretty faithful to kind of, you might say, philosophy self-image. Okay, so I mean, so it's a very useful book from that standpoint. But there are other kinds of sociologies of philosophy to be written, it seems to me. And of course, when we talk about the contemporary period, things get a bit dodgy. So it's very hard for him, for Burke Collins, the author, to find place for somebody like Kuhn, Thomas Kuhn, or Friedrich von Hayek, or Noam Chomsky, who are these people who are sort of outside of philosophy but have been very important inside of philosophy. Okay. So that these people don't really figure in that book either. Now that might just be an artifact of just dealing with the contemporary period, but it may point to a sort of deeper problem of how one identifies who philosophers are. Okay, so that's an interesting book. Now, it's obviously going to be quite arbitrary when one begins to talk about sort of history of philosophy and social theory in the modern period. But I think a few things need to be gotten on the table, and I think this is the kind of thing that becomes apparent to people who've sort of studied modern philosophy. First of all, in philosophy, in the field of philosophy, the term modern philosophy has a kind of curious meaning. I don't know if you're sensitive to this. It generally refers to the period starting from the scientific revolution in the 17th century to Kant. So when we talk about modern philosophy, we're going to take a course in modern philosophy. You end up studying basically 17th and 18th century figures. You study the so-called rationalists and empiricists. Okay? This is a very interesting use of the word modern. In a sense, it reflects a certain kind of usage that was around at that time in the 17th and 18th centuries. And the term kind of has stuck, you might say. So that even though we have these more contemporary uses of the word modern, having to do with modern art and modern other things, right? It's this older sense of modern as being anti-medieval, right, against the Middle Ages. So this is the term modern philosophy. Well, now modern philosophy, you know, so we're talking about people like Descartes and Spinoza and Leibniz, rationalists, right? We're also talking about Locke, Berkeley, and Hume, empiricists. Those are the kind of guys we're talking about. Now, interesting thing about all these guys is, you know, think about it for a few minutes. If you know anything about their historical, sociological background, none of them were professors. That's a very salient point about the history of philosophy, okay? That none of these guys, who are regarded as the foundation of modern philosophy, held chairs. It's not because universities didn't exist. Universities, in fact, had existed since the late Middle Ages, 12th and 13th centuries, okay? And this is part of what it meant to be modern, right? Part of what it meant to be modern was to be against academic culture, to be against the university, right? So cultivating a form of knowledge that was outside, right? Because what's happening in universities? Well, you're basically training people who are going to either be theologians or priests or lawyers or doctors. In any case, people who are going to have some kind of official capacity. It's like professional school, basically. Okay? And so these are people who are primarily, you know, if you go to a university, if you went to a university back in this period, and we're talking about the period leading up to Kant, so that's like to 1800, right? We're talking about people who really were dedicating themselves to more or less reproducing the existing social order, right? So it's kind of university education was a kind of conservative. Sort of conservative, conserving, and conservative kind of social function, both in the theological and the secular spheres. So, the kinds of things that we associate with modern knowledge, and especially modern science and things like that, tend to happen outside of these places. Now, this is not the entire story, because all I'm talking about here is sort of where the ideas come from. But of course, it's obviously the case, just as it is today, that no matter where the ideas or knowledge comes from, it eventually has to get into the universities if it too is going to be reproduced and made some kind of general vehicle of social knowledge. So the role of universities is very important here, even though they are primarily, in the period we're talking about, very conservative and even maybe reactionary. They are nevertheless essential for the reproduction of these new ideas as a general form of social knowledge. Okay? So that's an important point to keep in mind. Now, what kind of things did these guys, these modern philosophers, do? Well, first of all, the fact that they're rationalists or empiricists, this expression, doesn't really tell you much about what they did. In fact, this distinction is a distinction that Kant cooks up at the end of the Critique of Pure Reason. And Kant, in the sense, is telling us at the end of that book about, the marvelous work he's been doing in this book, right? So in other words, I'm synthesizing these two grand traditions that have existed since ancient times, right? Rationalists, empiricists, blah, blah, blah. He tells you this at the end of the book. He gives you kind of like a little historical summing up of what the argument has been about. And it's basically our buying Kant's story about his own significance in the history of philosophy that leads us to talk about rationalists and empiricists in the way we do. But if you actually look at these people, they don't neatly divide this way. Okay? And they were involved in all kinds of activities. So people like David Hume and also Leibniz, who are often seen as holding rather opposite views, were in fact both librarians. Okay? Leibniz was librarian to the Duke of Hanover, who was related to the what's now become the ruling house of Britain. Hume was a librarian at the law courts in Edinburgh. Okay. And John Locke was a physician. And Descartes was a sort of, you might say, a soldier of fortune / tutor to various nobles and things like this. This was kind of what he did. Spinoza was an optician. And Berkeley was a bishop, an Irish bishop. Okay, so these are the kinds of people we're talking about. They have all these different kinds of professions. And all of them, or at least most of them, would have gone to university at some point. Or have had some kind of formal training. All right. But the point is, given the kinds of things they were pursuing, they were not being, well regarded within universities. Now, it's not just these guys, okay, because these guys who I've just mentioned are all philosophers in a very recognizable sense. Namely, they spent most of their time writing and thinking and that kind of stuff. But there are also a whole other bunch of people who are around in this period, and they're normally the people who we see as responsible for the so-called scientific revolution, who were doing more than just, blowing hot air around. Right? They were actually doing experiments and, they were messing around with gadgets and they were studying nature and all this kind of stuff. Right? So we're talking about Newton, right, and Robert Boyle, and of course in medicine William Harvey, and Huygens in the Netherlands, and there are all these people. And these guys we don't normally call philosophers, but in fact in their day they were thought of as philosophers too, and they were called natural philosophers. And in fact, this distinction between being a philosopher and being a scientist is one that only gets established in the 19th century as part of a sort of retrospective understanding of what had taken place. It's a very good example of this kind of thing. Stephen Chapin, who's a historian of science, wrote an important book about 20 years ago now called Leviathan and the Air Pump. And it's about a very famous debate that took place over several years in Britain concerning a few things. But it was a debate primarily between Thomas Hobbes, who we normally think of as a political philosopher these days, and Robert Boyle, who we normally think of as one of the founders of chemistry, experimental chemistry. Okay? But these guys were having an argument on the nature of the vacuum, whether there was a vacuum in nature. Right. I mean, obviously, there seems to be a lot of air around, but the question is whether it's like pure air, where there's no matter floating around, or whether this idea that there is just this kind of matterless air, which is what a vacuum is supposed to be, right, it's just a kind of an artifact of the fact we just can't see those small atoms that are in fact populating space. Right. So that's kind of what the debate's about. And Robert Boyle basically said, we can do experiments to sort of show which of these hypotheses is correct. And Thomas Hobbes was saying, no, you can't. You can do all the experiments you want, but at the end of the day, there's always room for philosophical disagreement about how to interpret the experiments. Okay. As it turns out, Boyle wins this argument. Not only does he win the argument, he manages to exclude Hobbes from membership in the Royal Society, which is where this is all happening. And this begins a kind of tendency that you start to see kind of, it gets stronger and stronger as we move into the modern age, and that is drawing a line between what a philosopher does and what a scientist does. And a philosopher talks a lot of hot air, whereas scientists actually try to prove things by doing experiments. Okay? Now this takes a long time to actually get institutionalized, but by the 19th century it's becoming institutionalized. So if you were to go and look at all these guys who are called rationalists and empiricists, all these 17th, 18th century philosophers I mentioned earlier, and you look at the kind of things they wrote about everything, right? And a lot of these topics we would now call scientific topics, and they certainly held scientific opinions. Most of them turn out to be wrong by standards today. And in fact, that too is one of the things that marks them as philosophers. Okay? Because there's a sense in which this distinction between philosophy and science is a kind of self-serving distinction, where the philosophy is kind of the losing side. And you often get a kind of honorary, you got an honorary notice. So for example, Hobbes, if you read Hobbes' Leviathan, if you ever have a look at this book, which is a great tract of political philosophy, that's the way we look at it today. But in fact, it's a general metaphysical treatise. And the first part of which is devoted to matter and motion, basic laws of nature, set out in a kind of geometric form, you know, with a few axioms and then drawing some derivations. And then the rest of the book is applying that to how you understand human beings, and that's the famous part. Okay, and then the last part as well, which is on theology, where Hobbes tells you the implications of his use of theology, which were the things that he was persecuted for in his time because they turned out to be really massively heretical. Because Hobbes is like this really dyed-in-the-wool materialist. And you can imagine what the Bible looks like when you have that view, right? And so Hobbes was actually chased out of Britain for a while, and you know, and that's the part of the book nobody reads anymore. Because nobody's worried about whether Hobbes got the Bible right. Right? The part that's read is the political part. But that's a consolation prize. Nobody reads the first part, which is on the natural science. Because he seemed to be kind of a weird kind of combination of scholastic and proto-Newtonian and not really quite right about anything. And so they just... But that's the part that was actually the thing that laid the foundations for all of this political stuff that we associate him with, the social contract, right, the idea of the state as holding monopoly of force in the society, all these issues that are associated with the Hobbes viewpoint today were derived directly from certain views about the natural world. But because he was on the losing side of those issues, they are forgotten conveniently, and he's now called a political philosopher. Okay, I mean, that's a very important point. And this is true of a lot of these guys. Okay? So there's that kind of issue that we always have to confront, that there's a sense in which when we go to the 17th and 18th century, philosophy and science aren't very clearly distinguished in the minds of the people involved. They're very clearly distinguished by the time you get to the end of the 19th century, but they're not very clearly distinguished at the time of the people involved. Okay? And that's quite important. Now, somebody like Kant, who's living at the end of the 18th century, at the very end of the Enlightenment, is beginning to sort of draw these kinds of distinctions. Okay? And that becomes quite important for what happens subsequently in the history of philosophy and science, generally. Okay. So, let me say something a little bit more about science in the university. Because just like all of these great philosophers I was talking about from the 17th and 18th century, just like these guys were not in universities, neither were the scientists, the people who we call scientists. So Robert Boyle, for example, was very characteristic of the sort of people who were in the Royal Society in its beginning. Was a kind of man of leisure, a guy living off his inheritance, basically. And you know, this idea of you know doing experiments and messing around with nature as being something you did if you're a rich guy with a lot of time on your hands, is the tradition that actually goes back to Aristotle. And Aristotle says in the beginning of metaphysics that you ought to be turning to philosophy, and by philosophy, of course, he means in this broad sense, it includes science, when you have leisure. It's like the premier leisure activity. In fact, he recommends it sort of in the way nowadays we'd recommend physical fitness. Right? This is the kind of thing you ought to do. It's good for your soul kind of thing, right? It kind of betters you as a person. And that everyone who's got the time and the leisure ought to be doing it. And this is exactly the spirit in which these guys in the 17th and 18th century who were doing science, that's the way they operate too. And it's a conception of science that continues into the 19th century, one of the main examples of which is Charles Darwin, who never was a professor of anything, right, but was basically a failed medical student who lived off his inheritance for the rest of his life. And that's why he could take so long to write Origin of the Species. Didn't have to worry about tenure or the research assessment exercise, any of this crap, right? He could do it as long as he likes. And the only thing that made him publish it when he did was because of competition from Alfred Russel Wallace, right, who was about to publish a very similar theory. And so he got word of this. And now this raises a very interesting point about the way in which these people who were involved in science thought about their activity. Because they thought of it pretty much like a game, right? And you want to be first to the finish line kind of thing. But your income doesn't depend on it, right? It's not like Darwin is going to make more money if he publishes the theory first, right? That's not what's at stake. It's rather the honor, as it were, of being the first to come up with this particular theory. And if you look at the way in which the scientists in this period leading into the end of the 19th century, for the most part, right, they were not salaried people. They were people who did it because they wanted to do it, and there was a kind of sport in it. And I do think you've got to think about that sort of gamesmanship, sportsman-like aspect of it. And one of the things that made that possible was the fact it didn't cost a lot of money to do science. Or at least the amount of money it cost was something that a reasonably wealthy person could afford. So in other words, we're not talking about science involving big particle accelerators, like in physics today, that cost billions of dollars, right? We're not talking about those kinds. See, we're not talking about science at that scale, which you could never fund out of pocket. I mean, even today, social science research can't be funded out of pocket, can it, right? You need grants just to be able to do the surveys and to take the time and all the rest of it, okay? So, you know, this is a very significant feature about the political economy of knowledge production that we should never underestimate, is the fact that before the late 19th century, if you were a reasonably middle-class, wealthy person, you could fund the scientific research you wanted to do out of pocket. And that was, in fact, how it was done. And that the whole point of doing the science then was the issue of the honor and the glory and that kind of stuff. Being first, you know. And so if you notice, especially in the 18th century, and the Enlightenment, there were all kinds of prizes established. If you wanted to sort of look at the history of science in the 18th century, you could tell a lot of it just by looking at prizes. Prizes established, for example, to refute Newton. That was a very popular pastime in the 18th century. Newton's this British guy, here's the French in particular, you know, a little chauvinism operating there, and say, hey, if you can be the first guy to show that Newton's equations don't work, then we give you a big prize. And this actually led to a lot of good science. But who are these people who are doing this science? Well, obviously people with a lot of time and money on their hands. Or if they themselves don't have it by their own means, if they themselves are not rich through inheritance, they're patrons. Right? And patrons, you see, they like to support these guys doing science. It's a bit like, you know, when a big corporation supports, you know, an environmental movement, right? It's good for publicity. It's good publicity, you know. People think of me as a benevolent despot rather than just an ordinary tyrant who goes around, you know, extracting all kinds of surplus value from peasants and workers and things. You can think of me as a guy who has higher virtues because I'm also paying for this guy to do all this science. It's a very kind of common way of operating, okay? This kind of way of doing things began in the Renaissance, as you may know, in the 16th century, and it continues into the 18th century, applied increasingly to science. Okay, so if you didn't have the money yourself, you get a rich patron behind you. But the point is, you're not worrying about salaries. You're not worrying about delivering things on a bottom line. You don't have that kind of production line mentality. That only starts when you start to get into the late 19th century. And the first subject to be like that is chemistry, not physics. And it has a lot to do with the industrial uses of chemistry, but I don't want to talk about that right now. But in the period we're talking about here, science is something pursued in leisure. It is not a university subject. Now, why isn't it a university subject? Well, first of all, I should say some aspects of science are university subjects. Characteristically, they are ones that do not involve the use of your hands. Because remember now, universities are, I mean, the mainstays of the university, and this is very true still in the United States, which in a way has, whose model of the university is very classical, is liberal arts. Now, liberal, the word liberal means your hands are freed. That's what it literally means from the Latin. If you are engaged in liberal arts as opposed to the manual arts, right? That's the distinction we're talking about here, liberal arts versus manual arts. So the kinds of things that you're learning in the university from the Middle Ages on to the late 19th century don't involve your hands. So they're typically skilled speaking, right? Or, you know, maybe the only kind of hand skills maybe are writing. But, you know, like mathematics, I mean, actually, there used to be an enormous amount of positive valorization on being able to do the mathematics in your head, right? Being able to speak it. And there's, you know, now in our era of calculators, nobody takes it seriously anymore. But even when I was a kid, many, many centuries ago, there was still a certain kind of, you know, intellectual acumen was associated with being able to do sums and multiplication and all kinds of calculations in your head. This is really fading fast, though, this intuition, but this is very common. And I think you have to think about liberal arts education in the classical sense very much that way. So, for example, you know, you'd be trained to speak for a period of time without notes. Now, when we start to get into the 19th century, these kinds of criteria for judging intelligence start to disappear. And that, as it were, the manual side of it gets more publicly displayed. So it becomes okay to write stuff down while you're speaking or read from prepared text and stuff like that. That becomes much more acceptable. And a lot has to do with the nature of the subject matter and so forth. Right, that in some sense this is not really public stuff. Because if it were public stuff, we could just speak it, but because it's like sophisticated esoteric stuff, right, we have to write it down first, because otherwise we'd forget it or something. Okay? This is very much kind of a transition that occurs in the 19th century. All right. Now, if you think about the natural science subjects, the sort of experimental subjects in particular, right, they all involve apparatus. They all involve, you know, messing around with stuff for great periods of time, right, where you're not engaged, you know, if you're in a lab dealing with your assistants, you're not engaged in extended, lengthy discourses with rhetorical flourishes. It's a bunch of grunts and groans about, you know, adjusting the knobs and, you know, making sure the test tubes aren't overflowing, stuff like that, right? So from the standpoint of liberal arts, the actual experience of being in a laboratory is not very edifying, okay? To this day, we've got a lot of floating around the humanities faculty mostly, a lot of these unreconstructed liberal arts people who in fact would never get close to it, like, ooh, smells bad, you know? Those kinds of people. But you have to realize that that was in fact the normal position of academics. And so, in fact, one of the things the social history of science spends a lot of time talking about is how did they decide to put laboratories on university campuses? Because these campuses, right, are meant to be these idyllic places where you spend these years, you know, contemplating the mysteries of the universe and talking and so forth. And now they want to stick a physics or a chemistry lab that's just going to smell up the place. Right? So, there's enormous discussions if you go to the proceedings of a university record at Oxford or Cambridge in the middle of the 19th century. Right? Enormous discussions. Where are we going to put these things? Put them in another, you know, shire? I mean, don't put them here, you know? I mean, and to this day with a lot of the old universities, right, stuff's often on the outskirts. Right? You don't want them anywhere near where the proper people are doing the proper subjects. Okay? So if you look at where the experimental natural sciences get institutionalized in British universities, you've got to look at a place like Imperial College, right, in London, right, which was originally a kind of mining school. That's how, you know, it basically grew out of a mining school and then gradually took on all these other kinds of natural science-based faculties, okay, and one of the big champions of bringing all of these experimental things in there was Thomas Henry Huxley. you may know, Darwin's bulldog, right? He was for many years at Imperial College. He was the kind of big guy there. And really was the one who kind of midwived it to becoming a proper university in the at the very end of the 19th century. Okay? So it takes a long time. This takes a real long time. I mean, one cannot stress this too much because it is so common nowadays to think of the natural sciences, especially the more experimental, high-tech side of it, as being the blood and guts of the university. Whereas, in fact, it was a long uphill struggle from the 17th century, when this stuff first gets kind of publicly aired, to being institutionalized on a regular basis. Okay, that's the end of the 19th century. I mean, in a sense, the development of the polytechnics, starting with Napoleon at the end of the 18th century, and then throughout the 19th century, was meant as a kind of halfway house, right? It was a way of kind of, in a way, acknowledging that the natural sciences and technology require a kind of tertiary level of education beyond just primary and secondary school, but not quite at the level of the university. Right, so those polytechnics that get established were very much of that kind. And it just kicking and screaming, the universities only gradually accepted. And you then got to wait a little bit longer before you actually get natural scientists holding senior administrative posts in universities. Okay? One of the points that I always like to bring out, some of you may know, and this is really jumping ahead of the game, but now we talk a lot about state-industry-academia relations as being very essential to the growth of scientific knowledge and the growth of the economy and all this kind of stuff. Okay. And this is often portrayed as something that's the result of, what, World War II or the end of the Cold War. I mean, this is typically the time frame for it is usually put at the second half of the 20th century. Well, of course, this is totally false. And in fact, you start to see this in Germany at the turn of the last century with what would the Kaiser Wilhelm Gesellschaften, right, which are now the Max Planck Institutes. And this is how they began. The Germans had this idea too, right? The state, industry, and academia all working together in these kind of interdisciplinary things that will increase knowledge and boost the economy and all the rest of it. The point I want to make about this is that there was a lot of resistance within academia to do this, and that in fact the only way in which the academics got on board with this, which turned out to actually help massively increase the size of the universities, was because the German education minister at the time was a theologian, okay, Adolf von Harnack, who was a sort of liberal Protestant theologian, and he believed that science was a continuation of God's word, you know, very much like these liberal Protestants tend to do, and it was his authority as a theologian from one of the classical faculties of the university that actually sold this project. Now you might think, now God, you need a theologian to sell a project like this. This is a moneymaker. You know, nowadays you wouldn't need theologians at all, right? I mean, you could say this is the obvious winner, okay? But in the turn of the century, you needed a theologian to make this thing really culturally sound, okay? And that gives you a sense of the kind of cultural change that's taken place with regard to how one legitimates science. Because science can now legitimate itself on its own terms. It doesn't require a theologian sprinkling fairy dust on it, as it did in 1900, okay? But if you look, you know, one of the interesting things to do as a little project is to find out when do scientists or engineers or people of that kind start to be the presidents or the vice chancellors of universities? I don't mean polytechnics, I mean proper universities. You know, so for example, the retiring vice chancellor of Cambridge, Brewer's, is an engineer. That's pretty remarkable. Okay? I don't know if had there been previous scientists who were vice chancellors of Cambridge, I don't know that. But in the case of Harvard, for example, the first scientist president of Harvard was James Bryan Conant in 1933. That's the oldest university in America, founded in 1636. Okay? And this is quite characteristic. It's only in the 20th century. And for most universities, the second half of the 20th century, that you actually get these people rooted in the natural sciences being kind of the flagship people. And that gives you a sense of the cultural change that takes place in terms of what's leading the university. Because prior to that point, the more common faculties to get presidents of universities from were things like theology or law, things like that, the classical faculties. Okay? So this is quite important So you see kind of a big shift here, how the universities gradually start taking on board the sciences, and then nowadays being very much led by them. Okay? But it was a slow process to which there was a lot of objection. Okay? Now, somebody like Kant, Kant's a very interesting figure in all this, because Kant is a professor. All the people that I was talking about from the 18th and 17th century were not professors. Now, interestingly, of course, I don't want to omit a very important exception to what I've been saying so far. It's Sir Isaac Newton. Sir Isaac Newton was a professor of mathematics. He spent his whole career in academia. Okay? So we can't deny that fact. In fact, his chair, the Lucasian chair in mathematics, is currently held by Stephen Hawking. That's his chair. He's chair in mathematics as well. And now, this is an important point because, right, mathematics is one of the classical liberal arts subjects. And if you look at something like Newton's Principia Mathematica, because you got to think about, you know, what do you think about? You know, what's Newton important for? Okay, he's important for, like, mechanical worldview and all this. But in terms of his own work, Newton did a lot of things, right? He would go to the Royal Society and demonstrate experiments that he did with prisms. You may know about this, and optics. He did these prism experiments showing how light refracted and all that. He did that. That was what he was known for at the Royal Society. But he couldn't do that kind of stuff in the classroom. So the Royal Society is kind of like a hobby of his, right? It's this thing he does on the side. What he's doing in the classroom is he's doing standard sort of geometric proofs from Euclid, doing that kind of classical stuff. And if you look at his book, Principia Mathematica, which is the great sort of summa of the mechanical worldview, it is just laid out as geometric proofs. Right? I mean, it's a book of geometry, essentially. And in fact, it was one of the things that made the book so difficult to get published. Because here we've got this massive book with just proofs. Proofs, you know, basically showing how all of his laws, you know, he's got three laws, he's got the principle of gravitation. You get those things in place. If you know the initial position of the object you're looking at, you can predict where it's going to be somewhere else. Planet, or things on Earth. You can do it, according to Newton. And Newton basically goes through the laborious proofs of showing you how you do it, through calculation and through geometry. Now, who wants to read something like this? This was the problem of getting the book published, right? I mean, and in fact, he had a friend, Edmund Halley, of Halley Comets. You know Halley's Comet fame? He's the guy who bankrolled the publication of this thing in 1687, okay? But the thing that's interesting about this book, and what made it a real academic book, was first of all, it's in Latin, okay? And second of all, it is largely a book of geometry. It is a geometry of the cosmos. So there isn't stuff about doing experiments. The only kinds of experiments that you really see discussed in that book, you know, it's the kind of, you know, if you imagine, you know, how, those of you who remember doing geometry, right, you're often told how to sort of set up things so you can see the relationship between angles and stuff like that. That's the extent to which Newton conducts an experiment. Basically, it's a thought experiment. He tells you, if you imagine an angle like this and you bisect it this way, then this will happen. So there's no real proper natural science style experiment in that book. It's really a book of mathematics and geometry as would be understood by a person who's very classically trained if they want to go through the trouble of reading all this nonsense. Okay? So all of the practical experimental stuff that Newton did was done in the Royal Society outside the classroom. And as you know, Newton's Optics and Newton's Principia Mathematica are two separate works. They're radically different works. They look very different. And it does show, even in the great man's mind, right, there's a kind of, you know, some Marxist with the alienation going on, right? There's a sense in which there's the stuff that the academics will accept, and then there's the stuff that I can do for the Royal Society, and they don't really mix very well. And not only that, people have pointed out very quickly that Newton even seems to contradict himself on substantive points between the two books. And so the rest of the history of Newtonian mechanics is about trying to how sort this stuff out. The contradictions between what he says about the larger cosmos and what he says about light and sort of more micro stuff. So this is what's going on there with Newton. So Newton's an exception, right? He's a professor, but even Newton, right, there's a sense in which only some of his activities that we would now call scientific could be properly contained within sort of academic curriculum as it was understood in the late 17th, early 18th century. Okay? Now Kant, moving on to Kant, oh, one other thing I just mentioned about it. Newton, right, is no, you know, for, in his theories of motion and matter, right, for having explained how the planets move the way they do. And we often think about the discussion of the planets as being part of the branch of physics known as astronomy. And you say astronomy has something to do with telescopes. And isn't that like machinery? I think it's very important to realize astronomy is one of the classical subjects taught in universities. But astronomy was typically thought about as training for the eye, just like rhetoric would be training for the voice. I think that's a very important point to keep in mind here, how people thought about astronomy back then. So that if you were to look at the discussions of astronomy that take place in the Middle Ages, whether we're talking about it in the Christian tradition or in the Muslim tradition, right, which is really where the action's happening, it is very much a branch of optics, right? It's about how the eye works, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's like training for the eye. You've got to see astronomy as kind of a liberal arts subject, but you know, how to see keenly, how to see things right. That's kind of what, and indeed, right, one of the things that does provide a kind of an interface between the liberal arts culture and what will become the main experimental culture is this business of having an eye to see things right. I mean, you think about it, art history, we still have this kind of idea of being able to see things. And certainly, with a lot of natural history, being able to see what's happening in nature and so forth, it's all about the eye, having a skill, right, of that kind, being able to see properly. So astronomy, you know, because if you look at the history of science, one of the things that's very striking is the way in which astronomy, as a branch of physics, seems to be leading the way on everything. Seems to be the, and even philosophers of science, when they talk about science, they still tend to like to use examples from astronomy. It's a kind of holdover from that old view. Okay? So astronomy really kind of sets the pace for, because it is a kind of, it was originally conceived as a kind of liberal arts subject. Okay? Because remember, all these telescopes that I'm telling you about, you know, Newton or Galileo, right, all these guys, right, they are just inventions of the 17th century. They are invented then. People were looking at the heavens long before there were telescopes. Okay, let's not kid ourselves, right? I mean, people just have good eyes. You know, they know how to see things, and they know how to establish perspective, and they had all kinds of ways of doing this. And they had other instruments. But they weren't quite as machine, you know, machine-like as a telescope was. So as it were, a lot more of the skill rested in the eye itself. Right, so you talk about focusing the lenses of the telescope, for example, seeing farther and nearer. Well, that was the kind of thing that in the past you'd try to train your eye to do. You'd only get so far, of course, doing that, but that would be one of the things you'd try to train your eye to do. So it would be kind of, you know, so again, there's a sense in which you should think about the development of telescopes in astronomy pretty much like the development of calculators in mathematics. Right, where there's a sense in which the skill gets kind of offloaded after a while. So now we've got these radio telescopes, right, where the telescopes kind of take pictures of the heavens themselves and you just go in there and develop the film. Right, so you're not, you know, and so you don't really have to look at anything anymore except a photographic plate. And so if you've got the telescope aimed right and you've got it all set up, the machine does all the work for you. Just like a calculator does, of course. If you know which numbers to plug in, the machine does all the work for you. Okay? Well, this is part of, you know, I mean, again, you know, for those of you who like the kind of Marxist story, right, it's very much part of the alienation of knowledge production going on here, right, where the skills that were traditionally associated with the person and were, in a sense, used as a basis for judging the intelligence of the person, the skill of the person, get offloaded into these machines. Calculators, telescopes, stuff like that. So I make this little digression into astronomy because I think you've got to think about astronomy as these guys thought about it, not the way we think about it now as a very high-tech, machinic kind of subject, but it wasn't that way at all in the 17th century. Okay, so that's an important point to keep in mind. I mean, one of the things, of course, that made medicine a very difficult subject to assimilate very often was because of all of the interventions and stuff that involved mechanical things, right? So. But with astronomy, it was seen to be kind of a pure science of seeing. Okay, so Kant, let's get to Kant here. Now Kant is a professor, as I point out. Kant is a guy who spent a lot of his early career, first of all, Kant wasn't a professor until relatively late in his life, at least late by the standards of people living in those days, right? He was in his late 40s, okay? And if people are living only 45 years on average, if you're a professor at 48, you're really pushing the envelope, okay? And of course, this is before Social Security or anything like this, so there was no retirement age, you just dropped dead. So Kant didn't have to worry about that problem, okay? But the thing is that before he got his professorship, Kant was, he was like a lot of these Enlightenment guys. He was doing a lot of different things. He didn't have a regular tenured post, which meant that he was being paid, and this is quite, I think, quite important from the standpoint of the production of knowledge again, is that as universities expanded, they didn't necessarily expand in the number of tenured posts or tenurable posts, right? See, tenure is quite an important thing for universities, not only because it allows you a certain kind of intellectual freedom to do what you want, which is how we normally justify today, but also because it guaranteed a kind of steady income stream that enabled an individual to kind of, if they wanted to, do the same thing over and over again, predictably. Right? Because again, if we're talking about the reproduction of knowledge here, we have to think about what is exactly the mechanism by which this is happening. Well, one of the things you want is you want, as it were, the same people in post for a good number of years who are expert in certain areas so they can actually get the knowledge across. Now, to be sure, there were always people of this kind. But the point is, as universities expanded, right, as today, the expansion occurred mostly at the untenured level, the temporary people. And so you often had to be around for a long time before you actually got a tenured post. And this is what happened to Kant. So in that case, what were you doing back in the old days? Nowadays, of course, we'd say you'd be on short-term contracts. You know, teaching for 2 or 3 years, then teaching somewhere else 2 or 3 years, or being on a research contract 2 or 3 years here, 2 or 3 years there, right? And as you know, I mean, those of you who know anything about this racket, right, it doesn't add up to any kind of coherent academic career at all. You just become a kind of jack of all trades. And so if you're thinking about the overall systemic issue of the reproduction of knowledge over time, it ain't going to happen that way because these people are just trying to make ends meet. Right. Well, in Kant's day, they didn't have all this kind of stuff. What happened was they passed the collection plate around at the end of the lecture. It's very much like Protestant church service. You know, those of you, especially with the low church, you know, those of you who are Methodist, Baptist, these kinds of people, right? I mean, it's all about collecting money. To keep the parish going. And if you like the sermon, cough up a few dollars. Well, this is pretty much what Kant had to do, and it was normal. That was the normal way of operating. Okay, that was the normal way of operating. What Kant did was, Kant did two kinds of things, and this, again, I'm mentioning this because it's very common about what people were up to back in those days, is that you taught these very routinized subjects that were part of the basic, you know, bread and butter liberal arts curriculum that all the people had to get, right? And so Kant taught the full range of courses like logic and ethics and stuff like this. And then the rest of the time, he was trying to compete in contests. You know, Kant won a contest about what the origins of the universe was. He won the so-called nebular hypothesis that was originally, the universe was just a bunch of gas and then it settled down into material objects, right? And he was also writing essays, you know, what is enlightenment, you may know about that, and you know, he wrote a lot of very famous, popular essays. And that was kind of how he was known in the public sphere. He didn't write these big books that we associate him with, the Critique of Pure Reason, Practical Reason, and the Critique of Judgment. He didn't write those books until the end of his career, after he got the chair. The rest of the time, he was just trying to gain some recognition and pay some bills. That was kind of what most of these guys were doing at university at the time. They didn't have the leisure to write the big books. Okay? Now, nevertheless, the fact that Kant spent all those years teaching these very routinized scholastic subjects like logic and ethics and things like this really did some serious damage to his writing style. Okay? And I do think this is a very important point to understanding something about what happened to philosophy, you know, in the modern period. This business of it becoming professionalized, okay? One of the things, if you read Kant, that becomes very apparent is that here's this guy who's trying to say all these very interesting things, but he's straitjacketed by a certain style of writing that is very, what we would call, scholastic. where you have to lay out things. You have to divide things into four parts, into three parts, and then subdivide them. And, you know, in other words, the book is sort of shaped like glorified lecture notes. Right? And why? Because you're obviously thinking in terms of, you know, it's chunking, right? What we would now say, chunking the material, so that you can get it across to students one class at a time. That's kind of the model for this kind of writing. It's one you find in medieval scholasticism as well. It's meant to be kind of almost like a memory device. Right, you've got a big subject, you've got to break it down into parts. The parts have to be familiar parts. Now, familiar means familiar to the people who are going to listen to you or familiar to you as the lecturer, but it may be artificial to the content. And that's the big problem with not only Kant, but with the Hegel, with all these clowns, right? Is there's a sense in which there's a real problem of form and content going on here. Right, so it often takes forever just to figure out what these guys are saying. And this, you know, seems to me, is where the heavy hand of the institution can be felt. Right, Kant is basically not just writing what he thinks, right, from first principles. Rather, he's figuring, God, if I'm going to get this point across, I have to start with this structure people will, in some sense, recognize from other things they've studied, and then work all of my new insights into that. Okay, and obviously that's going to be a very tough thing to pull off. And if you look at Kant's writings, you know, you look at the big writings, the critiques, but even look at the little writings, the kind of things that get assigned in the philosophy classes today, you know, so like the Foundations of Metaphysics of Morals, for example, they're kind of like small versions of this. And you begin to get, and because they're a little loose, more loosely written, you begin to get a sense of, okay, I can see why he's doing it this way. You begin to see the examples, and the problem is when you look at the big critiques, what you've got is the big structure. You've got the abstract arguments. What you're often missing are the little examples that in fact make the stuff, gives the stuff some life, gives it some sense. Sometimes they're in the footnotes, sometimes they're just not there. Because these books, in a sense, would be used as, you're Kant, you've got the Critique of Pure Reason in front of you. That gives you the structure of how you lecture, but then you're going to spruce it up with some examples and things that are going to make it live for your students. But those examples might not necessarily show up in your text. And that's why, you know, you need to find out other ways of what the hell is he getting on about? All right? This is a very familiar problem that you see in a lot of academic philosophy, especially of the German kind, which is very scholastic. A really telling example of this kind of thing works in the modern period, very modern, recent past. Adorno. The very name scares people. One of the great defenders of difficulty in writing. Now, Adorno, of course, spent most of his career outside of academia in a private think tank, essentially called the Frankfurt School. But the thing is that he, of course, was, you know, trained in the proper German scholastic manner, and you read his books, and they certainly portray that background. But the interesting thing is that towards the very end of his life, when he did the last set of lectures he did in Frankfurt in 1968-69, before he died, Introduction to Philosophy, Introduction to Sociology, they've now been published by Polity. They're based on transcripts. So Adorno himself didn't write these things, he spoke them. Lo and behold, lucidity and clarity personified. In other words, if you find Adorno impenetrable, read those things. Read the transcripts of what he lectured. Because there you begin to get the sense of what's going on. You get the abstract, but then you get it all livened and made clear, and he starts addressing the students, but it doesn't show up in the written stuff. And what you've got, the feeling that you get from listening to this, and I think this is the way you have to think about these very difficult German texts, is that, in a sense, these books, no matter how long or big they are, and no matter how articulated they are at the end of the day just sketches. They're not really the whole thing. The whole thing happens in the classroom when you present it. Right? I say this because of the academic aspect of this. The fact that now we're talking about philosophy as an academic subject, something being done in universities, makes a difference here in terms of how you read these things. Because you've got to imagine there are students there, and there's some sense in which the context in which the delivery is taking place is going to complete the experience. It's quite different from, let's say, a person who writes an essay. You think about Rousseau, for example. Rousseau, totally anti-academic, lives in the late 18th century, influences Kant's thinking very strongly, very, very strongly, right? I would say Rousseau influences Kant at least as much as Hume, who's normally seen as a very strong influence on Kant. Okay? But Rousseau is an essayist. And he's not communicating to academics per se. He's not in front of, he's not in a classroom. He's not going to be fleshing out what he's saying in public that way. He writes these self-contained pieces that can be read pretty well by people who are reasonably educated, because he makes it all very explicit out there in the text. You know, just like an essayist would today. And that's why Rousseau gets assigned all the time. It's a, you know, social contract, nice thing to read, right? Very, very provocative, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you can have nice little seminars about stuff like that. Okay? Because it isn't meant to be kind of a lecture note. Okay? So the business about where the philosophy is being practiced, right, is going to make a big difference to how it's actually conveyed. Now, I mean, you know, in terms of sociology, a good example of someone who's very much like Kant and Hegel in this regard is, of course, Max Weber. Right, Max Weber, you know, God bless him, but, you know, this guy, you know, this is not what the man sounded like in the classroom, right? Because all you, I mean, especially if you look at the great unpublished work at the end of his career, Economy and Society, right? I mean, it's basically the outline of an encyclopedia, right? That's what it is, right? As you mentioned, you think this guy ever taught any of this shit? No, of course not. He just certainly didn't teach it in this form. Right? I mean, again, what we've got are glorified lecture notes. We've got sketches. Everything's a sketch. Doesn't matter how long it is. It could be hundreds of thousands of pages long. It's still just a sketch, which gets fleshed out in the classroom. Okay? Because there's an expectation that this thing is not just to be self-contained, but it's part of this sort of academic experience. And in this respect, right, what Weber does in books like that, in a book like Economy and Society, is really quite different from the standalone monographs, Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, right, which was finished and published in a couple of parts in the journal he edited. That's how it first originated, right? And there you got a somewhat different style, somewhat more accessible, somewhat more self-contained, something that looks a bit like an empirical piece of empirical research today. Okay. But in terms of the stuff that, you know, when we talk about Weber's concepts and all this stuff that's all taken from Economy and Society, right, it's very much in that old German style. But as a style, it's very significant because it presupposes a classroom and where the professor will, in a sense, be improvising on the spot to fill in the stuff. Heidegger, same thing. You might look at another difficult guy. Heidegger, one would say the same thing about that, too. Okay? Yeah?
Just to, I still don't quite understand the difference. I wonder whether there isn't more to it, because it seems to me that this German style you talk about is still very much taught and practiced in a way today.
Yeah.
If you look at how Habermas still...
No, I'm not denying it. It's gone. It's not gone.
I'm just wondering what might have the origin of it. And it seems to me...
It's the talking to students. It's the fact that the text isn't supposed to carry everything.
I think it's more. A sense that I have is that in the writing, the author has to disappear. Whereas, obviously, when the person speaks, the person is present. And that gives a very strong contrast between the two forms of expression, if you want, which seems to me is much less the case in English-speaking academic writings, where the author is present. These writings do come of the form, I think, and this is my view, and I disagree, etc., etc., which in the German style is not the case.
I think there's a kind of a variation. I mean, I don't know if I want to go into it right now, but I think there's a big difference between Britain and America, for example, where America is actually much more technical.
Yeah.
And much more Germanic.
Right.
Especially if we start looking at the kind of philosophy of science, philosophy of mind stuff. The British style is much more essayistic, but I think that has a lot to do with the roots that the British philosophy still has with the liberal arts tradition. It's less professionalized in that sense, right? And people, and Americans who trained in the British way, like John Searle, right, are still this very kind of unprofessional sort of philosophy that you can have on BBC as a Reese lecture, right? But even within English, I think there is a difference. But the German thing, I don't know, because the thing that's interesting to watch is how it's actually delivered, right? And I think it would be a mistake to think that, you know, somebody like Heidegger as we're literally spoke what's in being in time straight without anything else, I think that's a mistake. I mean, I think one has to imagine that there's a common taken for granted context which if the students didn't already have, he would be supplying. And in fact, you know, when you see with students of his writing their memoirs, they'd actually say Heidegger was like, you know, he was amazing. You know, and you say, well, I'm reading a text and they're totally incomprehensible. How could this guy be so amazing? Right? I realize the logical positivists and people like that thought that Heidegger was just mystifying them with word magic or something, but I actually think it's not as, I think the positivists are sort of mystifying Heidegger by doing this. I think, in fact, there is more than just the text. And that there's a lot of local stuff that just doesn't get written in, that isn't seen as relevant, but nevertheless gives some kind of meaning. And that's why I brought up the example of Adorno. Because Adorno, you would think, this is the last guy who'd ever make any sense. And yet, these transcripts of these lectures are incredibly lucid. They're incredibly lucid, you know? And he had a lot of students there, even though a lot of these students hated his guts, because what he stood for, he was seen as standing for the high Mandarin culture, you know, this is during, you know, it's the student revolt thing, 68, 69. And yet, totally lucid. And so what's going on? I mean, I think there is just a difference, you know, in terms of what you presuppose. Because I think there's a sense in which in the English-speaking world, we do sort of like the idea of the text kind of being self-contained, that it should all be there. Right, and often philosophers will be faulted because they're not making all the premises of the arguments explicit, and that's seen as a kind of failure. Right, whereas I think in the German context, no, right. I mean, there's a sense where this stuff is meant to be kind of elliptical, but it gets filled in context, and might be filled in differently too. That's the other thing. That's another thing English people don't like. That as it were, the same elliptical statements in one context may be, you know, as were interpreted one way. And the other way, another context interpreted another way. Right? So there's that as well. There's this kind of porosity of meaning that goes on. But I think that has a lot to do with the business of the presupposition of interaction, you know, that's taking place. And so what your text actually just gives you is lecture notes. I mean, this idea of lecture notes as being the basis for philosophy texts, the scholastics themselves picked it up from Aristotle because they had this strange idea that Aristotle actually wrote this way. Whereas, in fact, most of Aristotle's writings are just are lecture notes from students, and that's why they look like that, because they're meant to be lecture notes. I mean, this is the thing that's very ironic, in a way, that things that were originally lecture notes of students turn out to then be a model for writing, right, that then sets a certain standard for how you present philosophical material, at least in certain parts of the world. So you end up getting this very strange kind of development taking place. But Kant is sort of the guy who starts it. I mean, he's the one who really starts people down this, what we call a sort of German path. It has impact, of course, across all of the different academic disciplines as well during the period. Now, of course, you know, we only got a half hour more. Let's get in a little bit to the substance of what was going on here with Kant and what makes a difference here. I guess there are a lot of ways of getting into this. One thing that I think is very important about Kant, that I mentioned earlier, he provides a kind of transition point for assimilating the natural sciences into the sort of university curriculum, and that's because his philosophy is basically meant to provide some kind of what he calls transcendental, but might have been called previously metaphysical, justification of Newtonian mechanics. Kant is very strongly committed to Newtonian mechanics. He believes, and this is a view that was quite commonly shared in the 18th century, that basically that's the foundation of all science. We've got it nailed, finally. Let me put the point as provocatively as possible. I think the guys who lived around the time Kant did thought they knew a lot more than we think we know now. Okay? They really thought they had gotten pretty much the framework down, and everything else is going to be filling in the puzzle, filling in the pieces that are left over. I think that's a very important. That's a very important point. That accounts for a lot of what's going on in the rhetoric of this period. So, for example, this Enlightenment stuff, the truth shall set you free, right? We just got to, you know, spread all of this new science, these new ideas around, and everybody will realize how the past is just benighted and false, and we'll move on from there. Now, where does this come from, right? Well, they obviously thought They thought they had all the knowledge, the basic knowledge, nailed down with Newtonian mechanics. Now, not everyone thought this, but this was kind of a default position. This was kind of the normal position. And Kant definitely shared that. He definitely had that view. And so for example, if you look at the way the Critique of Pure Reason is structured in terms of the categories of understanding and the regulative ideals of reason, they are all sort of abstractions that can be derived from Newtonian mechanics. And in fact, when he tries to illustrate why he does the categories the way he does and why he does the ideas the way he does, he invariably goes back to Newton. Okay? And this is why, I mean, this is quite an important point in a way, because when Newtonian mechanics gets challenged as the basis for understanding physical reality at the end of the 19th century, Kant's authority starts to get challenged in a very serious way as well. So, for example, right, Newtonian mechanics presupposes Euclidean geometry. It presupposes absolute space and time. All these things are being challenged by the end of the 19th century. And so people say, well, Kant's in trouble too. Okay? That's an important point. Namely, there is this very strong faith in science. This is a much stronger faith in science, I might say, much stronger than the English people had. People like David Hume were fundamentally skeptical about what science could ultimately do. In fact, this is one of the reasons why David Hume and the whole British empiricist tradition generally is so much in favor with a lot of contemporary epistemology. Because their conception of knowledge and the sorts of problems of knowledge that they formulated were very indifferent to science. In other words, they didn't think that science was necessarily going to do a better job than what the ordinary perception can do. They're all going to run across the same problems at the end of the day. Whereas Kant actually did think there was a difference, that we had actually made some progress, we were actually somewhere, and that we could build on that. And this thing was Newtonian mechanics. Okay? Now, you know, what exactly does Kant like about Newtonian mechanics? Well, I mean, you know, it had certain proven effectiveness in the spheres in which it operated, no doubt about it. But also, I think another aspect of this that should not be underestimated, because this aspect comes out more clearly in the 19th century, is the fact that Newton was a man of God. Okay, and what Newton claimed to have done. Newton's no atheist. People like David Hume was a bit dodgy on the religious front, right? And he was often perceived as being an atheist. He probably was at the end of the day, too. But Newton wasn't. Newton was a very, very weird kind of religious guy, but very religious, and believed that basically Newtonian mechanics could help you do things like interpret the Book of Revelations. And, you know, you go to his library, most of his books are, in fact, on these theological topics, much more so than on the physics stuff. And, you know, this idea, by the way, is not over. I mean, you know, this idea of connecting up the physical universe with the mind of God, you know, Stephen Hawking, he didn't get that Newton chair for nothing, right? Stephen Hawking is just full of this stuff, right? It's the same thing Newton. Newton is exactly the same, right? Except Newton actually had more details. Stephen Hawking just waves his hands or waves his wheelchair a lot. I mean, but Newton actually delivered the good. And this was very impressive to Kant, because Kant, at the end of the day, was kind of a pious guy, too. Okay? Now, we're not necessarily talking about institutional religion here, you know, though Kant was, you know, raised as a kind of Lutheran background. But we're not necessarily talking about, we're talking about people who sort of believe that there's some sense in which we do have a connection with God in some way. Very much a kind of pietistic Protestant kind of thing. And Newton, in a sense, provided a kind of scientific infrastructure for this. Newton described absolute space and time as God's sensorium. That is to say, what we would now call an interface between God and creation. Space and time. You've got to, you know, so on one side of space and time is God, and the other side is the universe. Okay? And God sees the universe through space and time. It's like his grid. Okay? Kant loved this stuff. Right? He didn't necessarily think that this necessarily justified the existence of God, but he does say that we have to presuppose God in order for any of this to make sense. So what he does is he puts it in our minds. And that's what makes his philosophy transcendental, according to him, rather than metaphysical. Because metaphysical means, right, that the structure, you know, God and all of these objects and space and time are somehow out there, right? Metaphysics is a view about what the ultimate objects of reality are. But if you call it transcendental, what we're talking about, rather, are the things that we've got to presuppose in order to make sense of what's out there, keeping a kind of agnostic view about whether it actually corresponds to what's out there. Okay? So this is but in a sense, it's easy to slide between the two. But the point is that this is what Kant's doing. And so this aspect of the idea that you have to presuppose some kind of unity to the universe, you have to presuppose God as somehow being behind it, giving it a purpose, all these things he said we have to presuppose, these are the regulative ideals of reason. We have to presuppose all these things in order to make sense of the world in the ordinary sense. This becomes big business as we move into the 19th century in the German university system, which increasingly gets more and more idealized, spiritualized, right? So this aspect of Kant, which is in a sense kind of in the background, the presupposition, but isn't really, he never says like we can prove God exists. No, in fact he's against all the proofs for God's existence. He shows how they don't work. But nevertheless he says we've got to presuppose it. Okay? This presupposition gets more and more foregrounded as we move into German idealism. And in particular, people raise some very interesting questions about whether there's some sense in which God is a... if you take Kant seriously, that we have to presuppose God in order to understand the world the way we understand it, could it simply then be a matter of God just being a projection of ourselves? Why don't we just cut to the chase here, right? Rather than, say, making it into a kind of a logical thing, where somehow we have to presuppose God, why don't we just say, we just invent God as part of the way in which we make sense of the world? Now, this is pretty controversial stuff, okay? Because we're talking about Germany here. We've got country, not actually a full country, we've got a lot of little principalities, and we've got Prussia, we've got a lot of different states, most of which have state, religions, official religions, Protestant religions. And this idea that we project God, right, is a very blasphemous, or not, maybe not blasphemous strictly speaking, but subversive, politically subversive in countries where you have state-established religions. And this is exactly how it was seen. Now, there were attempts to get this negotiated in various ways, and this is where the whole map of German idealism starts to flesh out a little bit. And you've got people like Fichte, for example, and others who are very much part of the Renaissance of German universities. Humboldt, right, the famous Wilhelm von Humboldt, the first rector of the University of Berlin, which is where Hegel pontificated from, and Schelling, the other German idealist, became rector eventually. These guys wanted a kind of, they didn't want to be completely blasphemous about this, but they did want to say that in some sense, one can talk about God or the sorts of attributes we normally attribute to God as being projections of some kind of will or collective will or maybe nation, and then the university curriculum would, as it were, be the vehicle by which this is transmitted generation after generation. Okay? And this is a very important, very powerful kind of idea for the modern role of the university as a kind of bulwark for the reproduction of the nation state, for being a foundation of modern citizenship. Right, and as something that potentially everyone should be entitled to, right? Because if we're talking about the collective will of the nation, and we've got a nation with a lot of people in it, then they should somehow all partake of this. So this starts to place a kind of burden, you might say, that universities aren't just for elite people who are going to rule the country, but rather are in fact, because they're carrying the whole spirit of the country, that everybody in some sense should partake in it. And so this leads to the multiplication of universities. And in a way, Germany begins this process that eventually becomes kind of the normal course of things in the modern period. Okay? So that's one way in which this idea, this sort of spiritual projection that Kant was talking about, one way in which this really gets fleshed out and institutionalized in the German system. And also, university systems are, you know, influenced by it. And the United States is a good example of one that was very strongly influenced by it, much more so than Britain. In fact, Britain has kind of the medieval idea of the university almost to the bitter end, to the point that even PhDs aren't really required until my career, basically. Until the beginning of my career, you had a lot of people teaching in universities who didn't have PhDs. This idea of a research degree, right, was seen as a very optional kind of thing in Britain. Okay. So, but the point is, the other way in which this business of the spiritual, this idea of God being a kind of projection of humans, the other way in which this had a very substantial impact was, in a more obvious way, was in the teaching of theology. And I talk about theology here because theology is the biggest faculty. You know, if you're talking about the various faculties that exist in the university, in Kant's day, and let me tell you, 1896 is the last year in which the theology faculty, that there are not more theology students than natural science students, is 1896 in Germany. That's to say, all the natural sciences put together. Okay? 1896, I did a little study of this once, because theology has an incredible persistence as a bulwark of university life. Much longer than we usually realize. And not always reactionary. I mentioned earlier Harnack being very important in the Kaiser Wilhelm Gesellschaft, and it seems to be but you got to, you know, really take this into account. 1896, roughly same number of theology students and roughly same number of all natural science students put together in the country that was normally regarded as the most scientifically advanced country in the world in 1896 was Germany. That tells you something, doesn't it? I mean, it's a very interesting fact. Now, let's say we go back to the beginning of the 19th century and we're thinking about what theology means. It's a big deal, right? And in fact, when we talk about the pursuit of systematic knowledge, the Wissenschaft, right, which is kind of the academic disciplines, theology is the main one. And what the early 19th century is to a large extent about, and this is in light of what Kant did, is the autonomization of theology from the church. That is to say that the pursuit of theology as Wissenschaft is independent of any kind of doctrinal concerns of the established churches. And theology is the first subject, it's basically the battleground on which this issue, what we now talk about of, you know, freedom of inquiry kind of thing, academic freedom, it was on this subject that the battle was initially fought, on theology. This is a very important issue. I mean, and so if you look at Fichte, and you look at Schelling, and you look at Hegel, all these great German idealists, right, they are all cutting their teeth on theology. They all come up with very weirdo views about what the Bible is saying and what Jesus means and all the rest of it. And, you know, Hegel's world historic spirit is basically another way of talking about, you know, the Holy Spirit spreading through the world. I mean, that's what basically it's all about. And you go back to their early writings before they became famous, and all they're doing is they're doing riffs on theological interpretations. They're all doing biblical, you know, it's kind of like a Rorschach. The Bible's kind of like a Rorschach for the historical imagination. Okay? I mean, that's what... Now, you can imagine from the standpoint of the established churches, especially once the universities get revitalized and are made kind of part of the state apparatus, there is a lot of concern from the church about what's going on here. Okay? And indeed, once Hegel dies, all kinds of controversies start to arise. Hegel dies in 1830. This is a period where you're getting some serious civil unrest in Germany generally. And what you start to get is you get these bunch of guys coming along called the Young Hegelians, what Marx calls them, the Young Hegelians. And these are the people, they're sort of the generation after Hegel. They went to his lectures in Berlin. They're going to do this kind of secular move, right? They're going to sort of extend this outward, this sort of secular understanding of the salvation story as history, which is how they interpreted Hegel. Hegel's basically telling the Christian salvation story as secular history, right? And they're going to extend this into everything. Okay? And this has very serious consequences because, you know, you end up demystifying the sacred nature of everything. The Eucharist, you know, you name it, right? All the various ceremonies of the church, all this kind of stuff. And that's what the young Hegelians were doing. And this was a process that had already begun in the 18th century with a lot of followers of Spinoza, who himself had a very sort of heretical interpretation of the Bible, and very kind of what's known in the trade as naturalistic. Namely, what you do is you sort of, if you're looking at a biblical story, what you do is you imagine, well, could real people have really done that? And what you imagine is that the people who existed in the time of the Bible are not fundamentally different from the people who exist today. In a way, it's very similar to the kind of thing that Darwin did with regard to natural history, because one of the things about Darwin's theory of evolution is it's based on a simple principle, namely, the kinds of changes that you see happening today in nature are precisely the ones that were happening millions of years ago, and what you have to do is to extrapolate, okay, what would it have been like if those same, you know, projecting backward, given that it's the same process is going on? In other words, you don't imagine miracles, you don't imagine God zapping things in and out, you imagine basically the sorts of things that you can see every day happening around you. That's what was happening millions of years ago. That's the Darwin story. Well, this is what these naturalists in theology, they invented this way of doing things. And so what they're doing is they're looking at the Gospels. The Gospels are always fair game, right? Because you've got all these apostles bearing witness to Jesus doing this and that. And they say, wait a minute. Could it be that 2,000 years ago just a lot of freaky things were happening that just don't happen anymore? No, I don't think so. Right? I mean, that's kind of the way these guys, that was what the naturalistic perspective was. Namely, you had to basically imagine that the people 2,000 years ago are not fundamentally different from people today. And that may even include Jesus Christ himself. Okay? So what does this mean? Well, this means you have to start to think in other terms about what's going on. And this leads to a lot of different kinds of interpretations taking place. And this is in the trade they call the critical historical method. Right? Where what you do is, you know, you look at the language that gets used. I mean, one of the things that these people found very, very quickly was that these gospel stories are written way after the events actually happened, because the language isn't even the kind of language that people would use. So you already get rid of, you know, in terms of these texts being sacred texts in the strict sense, that's already eliminated. See, when this was being done originally in the Enlightenment in the 18th century, it wasn't being done in universities. It was the kind of thing that people did on the side, often being persecuted by the church. But it wasn't being institutionalized in the university. What you begin to have happen in Germany in the 19th century is you actually have this activity taking place in theology faculties and universities, to whom students, some of whom are going to become priests, are being taught this stuff. And that's where the real problems start. Right? And so you get enormous scandals taking place. And a couple of the major players in these scandals are people who Marx is very strongly influenced by. And Marx, you know, was a law student at Bonn, University of Bonn, never actually saw Hegel operating. He was too young. But he was very much taken by these young Hegelians who were of the generation between him and Hegel. Marx wanted to pursue a career as an academic, but couldn't, because by the time he was on the scene, these young Hegelians had caused so many problems that there were now religious loyalty oaths that you had to take in order to become a professor at a university, and Marx just wasn't going to stand for it. He was an atheist, and he was loud and proud, and so he became a journalist, basically. Right. Founded a newspaper in Cologne, and then got kicked out various other places, and landed in Britain, where they tolerate everything. But the thing is that the people who Marx was influenced by in this regard, one of them was a guy who was an incredible big cause célèbre in his lifetime and got kicked out of his university post, and that was David Friedrich Strauss. And if you read the book The German Ideology, there's a discussion of him. And he wrote The Life of Jesus. And boy, Jesus comes out as this very ordinary kind of guy. Nevertheless, what Strauss wants to say is this shouldn't cause you to lose your faith, right? And this is the point these young Hegelians are always making, which is one of the things that Marx ridicules them for. These guys are saying, look, you know, the real test of faith is that no matter how many things you find out to be false about the Bible story, you still believe. And Mark says, what rubbish, who's going to believe this? And see, one of the things about the about what Marx is saying in the German ideology that's quite relevant to all this is this idea that these young Hegelians, no matter how radical they were on paper, no matter how critical and sophisticated they were just totally, they lacked what we what might call nowadays sociological reflexivity. They had no sense of what impact what they're saying would have on the larger society in which they were operating. In a sense, they presupposed such a rarefied Enlightenment mentality that they were just clueless. They didn't know what hit them. So Strauss lost his professorship. Okay? Now, Feuerbach, who's the other guy, he didn't lose his professorship, but he got into enormous amounts of trouble. He was the way he would justify it, well, look, one of the great things that we can say is that, in fact, Christianity isn't just this weird miracle out of nowhere, but it's in fact continuous with other anthropological practices of ritual and worship that we find throughout primitive culture. Now, there's a selling point, right? You know, and he says this proves the universality of the Christian message, because you find it in other cultures too. It's just that Christianity is a little bit more self-conscious, perhaps. Now, you can imagine how that went down. Well, the point is, you see, now Marx, this is what Marx is looking at, right? And it's really kind of an important point to keep in mind about, you know, where somebody like Karl Marx is coming from. Because Marx, throughout his whole career, is very much preoccupied by the separation between the ideas, right, and the social reality, right? This is like a big thing. He's always, now, where does this fixation on this come from? Well, it comes from this, right? It comes from all of these conflicts over theology, right, where the people who are making the arguments think they're being perfectly reasonable, objective, they think they're flattering their audiences by, you know, commenting on how smart they are, by saying, look, you guys don't need the Bible to believe in God. You guys don't need to think Jesus Christ is God. Nah, come on, you can get rid of all that nonsense. It's all primitive nonsense. You can still believe God even without this stuff. And not surprisingly, you know, the religious authorities are wondering, what the hell are these guys doing? Okay, and Marx, and the interesting thing about Marx is that Marx basically blames the young Hegelians for their own problems, right? Marx, in this way, Marx is a very hard-nosed, you know, kind of political realist about things. Marx saying, look, if you're going to be talking about this radical stuff that is quite explicitly undermining the means by which religious authority is being exercised, and the religious authority is part of the state apparatus, don't be surprised when they start coming after you. This is stupid. If you really want to change things, you've got to do something different than just say these things. And this is where you know, Marx starts to think about things like you need social formations, right? You just can't just speak the truth to power in some kind of straightforward way, the way the guys in the Enlightenment thought. That doesn't work. You have to first organize people in a certain way. You have to get them mobilized in a certain way. You have to, you know, have your flanks covered in various ways. And this is why after Marx, you know, starts to think about the fate of these guys, he starts to get more interested in issues of the social organization of knowledge and ideas. And he, when he moves to France, right, where he sees a lot of this happening already, I mean, because, you know, in France, we've got the positivist movement a la Comte and Saint-Simon and all of those utopian, so-called utopian socialist guys floating around. They are trying to do stuff like that already. Not by a Marxist means, but nevertheless, they are very self-conscious of the need for social organization. If one is going to transform society, it is not enough to stand up in a pulpit and speak truth to power. Nothing happens that way. Except you get repressed. What you have to do is you have to have an elaborate social organization in order to do this. And so this gets us to a certain, I see we're almost finished, it gets to a point where we begin to see philosophy and social theory are beginning really to converge here, right, at this point. Because we're getting this guy Marx, who sees kind of the failure of the Enlightenment just as a straight intellectual project in the kind of social environment in which it's operating. And of course, you know, the other precedent for the Enlightenment having some, you know, implications with the French Revolution, and that was a mixed bag. right? And so Marx is reflecting on all this. He's reflecting on all this stuff. Okay. And so then the issue becomes, you know, there are a couple of issues on the table. The main one being, what is the form? You know, what kind of form can if you want to use certain kinds of ideas as a way of improving or revolutionizing even society, what is the form that takes sociologically? Right, now obviously the university being reinvented in Germany in the early 19th century with Humboldt and Kant and all this stuff, that was in fact one attempt to organize ideas in a way that would be of some long-term social improvement and benefit. And it no doubt had that effect, because the universities were the guys who gave us the young Hegelians and gave us Marx and all the rest of them, even though they all got kicked out eventually. But nevertheless, that was very important. But what other social formations are there? You know, and what about this proletariat, you know, whatever that is? Yeah, I mean, you know, is that something like a glorified student union? I mean, you know, what is that? You know, I mean, because that's an issue that's going to arise. But also there's going to be this issue about what happens within the university itself. So now that we've got philosophy inside the social formation of the university, right, then it starts to get its own trajectory that's in a way bounded by the university as a kind of autonomous social unit. And this is where we start to get things like professionalization and disciplinization and specialization and all these isations, right, that are characteristic of the way in which, right, the fields are today. Okay? So next time, that's where we'll start the story. So that gets, you know, so we'll start the story maybe roughly third quarter of the 19th century and then move forward into the present day. Okay, and I'm gonna see if this we'll see if this works. Well, it's still ticking. Okay. So what I'll do